You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2021 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 8, today we are in Le Grand Bornand.
And what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? Heard the sound of a thunder roared out a warning. Heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. Heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. Heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. Heard one person starve, heard many people laughing. Heard the sound of a poet who died in the gutter. Heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's a horn, and it's a horn, it's a horn, it's a horn, it's a horn train gonna fall.
That was absolutely tremendous. Played in tonight by Kate Wagner and Francois Thomazeau.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
I must say, this is definitely one of the best Dylan tunes.
There we are. There we have it. There we have it. You're wondering about the reasoning behind that, the rationale behind opening with A Hard Rain Gonna Fall. That is, in Francois's view, one of the best Dylan tunes. And it was an appropriate song for today because A Hard Rain was a falling today, wasn't it? And
Dylan Tunes won the stage.
He did. How long can we stretch this out for? I think probably the whole episode. Another enthralling day's racing. Where are we, Francois?
Well, now we're in La Clusaz, which is quite a famous ski resort, not far from Le Grand Bornand. It's actually, we're really next door to Le Grand Bornand. And it's famous here, well, actually more famous for Nordic skiing originally than it was for alpine skiing, even though all these places where we are going, there's always famous alpine skiers, but you don't know anything about alpine skiing and you don't care.
So I love skiing.
Yeah, so there was a couple of famous, at Le Grand Bornand, the famous skier is Tessa Worley, who is French, so from Australian origins. She was world champion of giant slalom. And in La Clusaz, the two most famous skiers from La Clusaz, the most famous one is Edgar Gropion. He was the first ever Olympic champion for moguls. You know, these strange going down the slopes, on bumps and stuff. He was a very outspoken character and a very exuberant character. And the other alpine skier, very well known, was Regine Cavagnu. She was world champion of Super G in 2000 in Austria, and she sadly died in training. The same year, she actually, she was skiing down the slope, and a guy was there on the slope as well, looking after the slope. There was a collision, and she sadly lost her life. So yeah, we're in the land of drama, in the land of skiers, in the land of high mountains, in the land of changing weather, and that was the case again today.
Quite a change, wasn't it, today driving? Well, we've covered a lot of ground the last couple of days, and Kate, of course, this is your first Tour de France, and we very much drove into the mountains today, didn't we? And you were quite bowled over, I think, by the change in the terrain and in the countryside around us.
You know, I've been to the Alps once before. My family did a week in Lauterbrunnen in 2017. It's the first time I'd ever seen mountains this huge. You know, in the U.S. we have mountains, but they're nothing like this. And every time I'm here, well, I guess this is the second time, but every time I'm here, I think about the English philosopher Edmund Burke, who is, a reactionary or whatever, but he coined the term the sublime to describe specifically these situations which arouse in people this sense of pain and danger, but also like the vastness of it, which is so incomprehensible. And I think about that every time I look at the Alps, because the vastness of it is unbelievable. And, watching the terrain change, watching it go from rolling foothills, sweeping up into these massive cliffs and massive walls of stone. It's a really abrupt change, and it's almost like being caught in the current of a wave.
Kate, you were conducting yourself. That was a bit like having Chiru on the podcast for a moment there, the hand movements, moving the microphone all the way around, but you were describing, or with your hands, the mountains. And really, we're day two in the Alps tomorrow, and we're in the real Alps tomorrow, perhaps. These feel almost like foothills in a way. It was the type of stage today, category one mountains, where it was a short stage. And after yesterday's kind of all-out action, we were perhaps being greedy to expect another very exciting stage, but that's what we got, with very aggressive racing from the gun. Stage 8 from Oyonnax to Le Grand Bornand, 150 kilometres, which is a short stage. Three first category climbs on the menu today. Would the riders be stumbling on the side of the 12 misty mountains? I'm not sure if there were 12, but there are other mountains as well. There were a few crashes. Mike Woods overshot a corner. Jonas Vingegaard was very badly cut up in a crash. Miguel Angel Lopez crashed today as well. Stefan de Bon had a bad one, the Astana rider. He finished 30 minutes down. So it was dangerous with the hard rain of falling as it was. Wout Poels was the first attacker as they went uphill from the gun. He was obviously determined to be in the breakaway. Obviously his teammate Matej Morohic won the previous day. Lots of big riders were in trouble very early. Geraint Thomas, very early to slip out the back. Then Primoz Roglic and Pierre Latour, the curse of Francois Tomaso, because Francois, you spoke to him last night.
Absolutely.
When he was last night, he was having a very good tour. Tonight, not so much. Roglic was on his own for a lot of the time, which is, on the one hand, surprising to see a rider like that, you know, one of the real hot favourites coming into this race, being abandoned by his team. But not surprising either, because they had Wout van Aert going for the yellow jersey today, and Jonas Vingegaard protecting his GC position. But he cut a forlorn figure, didn't he, Roglic? He looked like he'd stepped in the middle of seven sad forests, been out in front of a dozen dead oceans, been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It was a fast, frantic start to the stage. Sonny Colbrelli was very aggressive. He won the intermediate sprint in front of Michael Matthews, gaining a few points in the green jersey competition. 50 kilometres into the stage, a group of 20 went clear. It had Tadej Pogacar in it, but not Richard Carapaz, who looked dangerous yesterday, and nor Mathieu van der Poel, whose team is staying just up the road from us, 100 metres or so, in a hotel in the village here. The way that van der Poel rode today, he was resigned to losing the jersey today. There wasn't too much of a defence from him, and he did lose the jersey. Wout Poels had another go. Van Aert, very much in the hunt for the yellow jersey, he joined a little move with our very own Connor Swift of the Cycling Podcast. Finally, the break formed, the big break of the day. 18 riders were in it, some good riders too. Sepp Kuss, Jonathan Castrovieco, Michael Woods, fancied rider for today, Kenny Ellison, Alejandro Valverde, Mattia Cattaneo, who was very strong and very impressive today, Guillaume Martin, Nairo Quintana, Søren Krogh Andersen, Nans Petters, Tesh Benoot, Dylan Toons, Chris Yule Jensen, Simon Yates again, Yoni Zagiri, and Sergio Henao. I've not even named all of them, but almost. At one point, Valverde sat up, and that caused a bit of confusion, but he was freezing cold and apparently shaking by the time he went back to the bunch. Wout Poels was scooping up mountain points on his way to taking over the lead in the King of the Mountains competition. Søren Krogh Andersen and Tesh Benoot got away together. Krogh Andersen was inching closer to the yellow jersey. He, at one point, was very close to being virtual yellow jersey, but that eluded him in the end. He dropped Benoot. Then Michael Woods bridged across and dropped Krogh Andersen on the Col de Rome. And behind, where had he been, our blue-eyed son? He saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it and attacked Tadej Pogacar, that is, with 33 kilometres to go. Richard Carapaz, very quick to respond, got up to him, but made a big effort in doing so. Pog went again, Carapaz was gone, and that was the race over. It might be the race over, who knows? For everyone else, for the race, it was the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning, the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. Pog was 3:40 down on Woods at the top of the climb and a minute clear of Carapaz. But on the La Colombière, the final climb, Toons caught and then dropped Woods, perhaps surprisingly. Pogacar, meanwhile, closed a three-minute gap on the leaders on the climb. He's crossed the top just 20 seconds behind Toons, but then took it pretty conservatively on the descent and came in with Michael Woods and Jon Izagirre, who won the sprint for second. So Dylan Toons won the stage. Jon Izagirre was second. I think he won into Morzine a few years ago in very similar weather, didn't he? Cold and raining at the end of the tour. Mike Woods third. Pogacar fourth. Wout Poels, Simon Yates, Paddy Pantsch is sixth. On GC, Pogacar takes over the yellow jersey. Van Aert now 1:48 down. Look at the gaps, or listen to what these gaps are behind. Lutsenko 4:38, Uran 4:46, Vingegaard 5 minutes, Carapaz 5 minutes and 1 second, Mark Cavendish still in green jersey, Wout Poels now in the King of the Mountains jersey, and in the gruppetto, the people were many and their hands were all empty. 90 riders were there and they finished 35 minutes down.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2021 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
I'm Elise Chabet and I'm racing for Canyon SRAM Racing. I was really surprised how the body reacts to, particularly to intervals training, because like when you do hard intervals, you really see the glucose level like really peaking quite high. And so that means that the body is reacting well to the effort and is like releasing the glucose in the blood and for the muscles. So yeah, that was actually quite interesting to see that. Like also when you come back from a long ride or from an interval ride, to see that the glucose level is really dropping if you don't eat like a recovery shake or like something just after. So yeah, we can really see that it's really important to feed just after the effort. I was quite surprised, yeah, because we trained in altitude now, and compared to when I train like in sea level, like I can see that my body needs more like food and needs more like also glucose like to achieve the good training. So that I could really see also with the Super Sapiens, to see that I need to eat more to have the same glucose level. Yeah, also like for example in the morning, you also see that when I wake up, I have also a peak like before even having breakfast, and that shows that my cortisol level is also working. So yeah, I mean that's also interesting to see that the hormones have like high impact on the glucose level.
Well, it was Elise Chabet, the Canyon SRAM rider, telling us about Super Sapiens, and we're running a competition in conjunction with our title sponsor Super Sapiens. If you'd like to win 3 months worth of the sensors that you wear on your upper arm to measure your blood glucose levels, then send us an audio clip. You can see how to do that at thecyclingpodcast.com, and we'll hear some more clips that have been sent in over the course of the Tour de France. Elise Chabet, interestingly, is riding the Giro Rosa at the moment, the Women's Giro d'Italia, and it's funny because I was keeping an eye on this today as well, and I think there was quite a lot of resignation around the tour today at the manner of Tadej Pogacar's performance and the fact that with 2 weeks to go and after such an exciting opening week, it almost seems like the tour might be over. At the Giro, Anna van der Breggen today won stage two by 1:22 and has a very commanding lead overall. And in fact, there was a 1-2-3 for SD Works there, so we're seeing sort of incredible domination there, and it happens, it does happen from time to time. And I guess we want still to have an open race. We don't want the race to be over after 1 week. There will be obviously lots of other stories to be written and told, lots of stages to be fought for, but that was today an amazing performance from Tadej Pogacar, and I think it was a response to yesterday where there were questions about his team. His team, as Mark Hirschi told us last night, went to sleep, missed a big move. It was very clear yesterday that Pogacar, for all his strength, cannot rely on his team. And I think today was him taking matters into his own hands and seizing control of the race in a way that he's able to do. His coach, Inigo San Milan, actually tweeted today, offensive operations oftentimes is the surest, if not the only, means of defense. George Washington, 1799, said that. Not about the Tour de France, because it didn't exist at the time.
Oh, I thought it was Johan Cruyff, you know, who said the best defense is attack. But yeah.
But interesting that's what he said, because it was obviously an aggressive act, but it was also a defensive act in a way, because it just allows him to get himself in the position he wants to be, and his team now has quite a different job to do.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of short of words to describe what Pogacar did. Well, you know, we already call him Pog all the time. I mean, we were wondering about dynasties starting, and from what we've seen today, we're in for a long, long dynasty of Tadej Pogacar winning the Tour. You never know, of course. I mean, anything, as we say, anything can happen. It can crash. But let's face it, is really, we had the impression today, we have seen impressive moves in the mountains by Chris Froome or, Merckx or anybody. But that's very rare that you see someone pull away with such ease. Like he had another extra gear on his bike that nobody else has. And the way he won, I'm almost tempted to say he won the stage. I mean, you could tell when he went down very, very smoothly and not making any efforts, because he'd done his job, which was to actually, even if he said the opposite, but which was actually to kill the Tour and kill the opposition, because everything is irrelevant now. He purposely didn't chase for Dylan Toons. He could have won the stage had he wanted to do. And we saw at the finish, he was with Michael Woods, Ion Izagirre. You know, they both sprinted for what? Second, third place? You know, the little crumbs, you know, the normal humans go for. And he didn't bother. He let them go. It was not his race anymore. And tonight, when I read statements on my, you know, on my mail, on my email box, when I read tweets and everything, when you see, you know, teams saying, oh, Sergio Henao is now 11th, or, oh, so-and-so is doing this and that.
They're like 30 minutes down.
It's absolutely irrelevant, you know. Now, what next? What I'm a little bit worried about, we had one of the most exciting first weeks of the Tour for many years. What's left now? Not much to look for. I'm also worried that, you know, with very important goals still, you know, on target for many riders, like I'm thinking Mathieu van der Poel, I'm even thinking of Wout van Aert, and I'm thinking of the Olympics. Why should they stay in the race? What's left for them to go for? Well, stage wins, of course, but the way, you know, Pogacar crushed the opposition today, and if he does the same tomorrow, and if Wout van Aert was 148 down, is dropped again, and it's probably going to be the case, what's going to be left of the Tour de France? I mean, well, we have more chateaus, wine, cheese to talk about, but I'm afraid we won't have a lot of cycling.
François, the plural of chateau is chateau.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question. I think part of the reason this... Sorry, it doesn't suck, but I mean, part of the reason why this is so disappointing is because the Olympics has everyone in its grip. If it weren't for the Olympics, I feel like we'd see like a lot more daring, exciting stuff, but everyone's conserving their energy for that. And so it's like, it kind of puts a stranglehold on the Tour that feels kind of honestly unfair. And second of all, I think that, you know, I mean, we probably will see a lot of struggles for breakaway wins, things like that. I mean, I still think it can be an exciting Tour. Is the GCE battle no longer exciting? Certainly. But again, anything can happen. I mean, the thing also about dynasties is that it's interesting to me because part of the reason we have such a bad taste in our mouth about dynasties is because the last one we lived through was Chris Froome. And the Froome dynasty is like rather different than like, say, like the Merckx dynasty, for example. Or like, I don't know, maybe Indurain. But really, like Team Sky and like, and, you know, Postal Service before that, it was... They did the same thing every race, control the race, ride in a train, make sure... I mean, and that's what made it boring. But what's interesting about Pogacar and what's interesting about UAE is that they don't have that power. Pogacar's win today was almost entirely on his own and an entirely, like, individual triumph. And so when it comes to defending that, his team is... not going to be able to do what like an Ineos would do or like what a Jumbo-Visma would be able to do if they weren't, you know, all maimed or whatever. And so it's interesting to ask, like, you know, of course we're going to now have an arms race where they get more and more powerful and more, you know, substantial domestiques to help him out, and it's going to maybe become like the Sky Train again. But for the time being, it really is kind of like cowboy cycling, and that's exciting.
That's an alternative take on it. I mean, we hope for something, don't we? I mean, in terms of precedence, this is his. He won the Tour de France last year. Pogacar. I was looking at Eno in '79. His second tour, he won that by 13 minutes. He won seven stages. He crushed everybody. And I think, you know, for all the, and I can see already the skepticism about Pogacar's performance today, which is natural enough. But there are two things. Pogacar is clearly a supreme talent, a once in a generation talent. Also, a lot of his rivals have crashed and are. If Pogacar is 0.5% better than everybody else, and that's kind of all you need at this level, his rivals are all losing several percent because of their crashes. And yeah. It's not just the injuries. We heard from Mark Hirschi yesterday about how you struggle to sleep, and if you can't sleep, you can't recover. You look at Eno's record. You know, I mean, Eno is, in many ways, for me, the benchmark. And he rode his first Grand Tour in 78. He was first. In the Vuelta, he was first in the Tour in 78. He was first. These are all the Grand Tours he rode. First in the Vuelta, 78. First in the Tour, 78. First in the Tour, 79. First in the Giro, 1980. Didn't finish the Tour in 1980. First in the Tour in 81. First in the Giro in 82. First in the Tour in 82. First in the Vuelta in 83. Second in the Tour in 84. First in the Giro in 85. First in the Tour in 85. And second in the Tour in 86. That was Bernardino in Grand Tours.
Yeah, I think that obviously from what we've seen today and whatever the future lies in the future, Pogacar has made the same kind of impression as, you know, a rider of this caliber of Eno. And what's left now? You were mentioning the weakness of his team, Kate. For now, it doesn't matter. In the future, yes, it'll be better surrounded. But what will be the use of a team around him in the future? It's just safety to avoid, in case of a problem, someone who's there to give his bike away, or, you know, this is the kind of help he will need. But apart from that, we saw and where the comparison with Eno and other greats of the past stands is that. I mean, he really crushed the time trial. So, if everything goes according to plan, he will again dominate the last time trial in Saint-Emilion. And in the mountain, is peerless. I've rarely seen two flat levels, you know, of I mean, once again.
Since Armstrong.
Armstrong was usually, yeah, crushing it. Well, there was always Ulrich, or there was always someone.
Yeah.
The last time we had, and I agree with Richard on that, the last time we had such an easy tour, I mean, if it is an easy tour, we never know, we don't know for now. We'll see tomorrow, we'll know more tomorrow, but was Nibali in 2014? Because he finally won with 7:37 from Jean-Christophe Pirro. But one of the reasons was that his main rivals, you know, also crashed. So we're in that kind of position. Maybe we have, you know, the view we have and the view I have is distorted by the fact that this morning, I mean, when the race started, and this is something we've already forgotten, but before the first climb, and it was a third category climb, already Geraint Thomas and Primoz Roglic were out of it, you know. So, I mean, they were probably the ones among the ones who had a chance to stand up to Pogacar, and without these guys, now it's kind of a free ride for Pogacar.
Yeah, it sometimes feels to me that like Roglic is the only one who can take on Pogacar as an individual, whereas Thomas has a team behind him that was supposed to be, you know, this four pronged or whatever GC attack. And now, like Richard said, it's a chopstick.
It's a bit of a broken chopstick. I mean, Carapaz looks so. I mean, he always looks dynamic. He looked. It was encouraging yesterday that he was so prepared to take the race to Pogacar and attack him. But today, he was the only guy to respond when Pog attacked, but Pog broke him. He just broke him, and Carapaz is one of the best climbers in the world. And he then lost another 3.5 minutes, and he could have lost more.
We're in a heavyweight boxing world championship situation where Pogacar is kind of, you know, Ali or Mike Tyson, and we're really looking forward to the big showdown with Egan Bernal, because if somebody now, you know, seen from different perspective out of the tour, if there is someone in, and we're really looking forward to that confrontation in the Grand Tour, a top form Egan Bernal against a top form Tadej Pogacar.
Remco, are you listening?
Well,
Remco
is not today's man. He's probably tomorrow's guy.
Yeah, but should we be down about that? I mean, you mentioned Muhammad Ali and the greats, and you know we celebrate Eno and Marx and Anquetil and Coppi and Indurain, less so maybe, but I lived through the Indurain years and I find them pretty boring. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, Pogacar is not that sort of rider. He is an attacking rider. We should be celebrating that fact. Also, there is an awful lot more to fight for in this tour. The podium, the King of the Mountains, the stages, the green jersey. There's an awful lot else going on in this tour. And we can be guilty, and we are guilty, and we've been told this by people before. We can be guilty of focusing too much on one aspect of the race, which is the yellow jersey, which is obviously the most important aspect of the race, but it's not the only one.
Well, you know, in a football match, okay, you can write lots of stuff about the red cards and the goals and the missed penalties, but what matters at the end of the day is who won the game.
I think it's worth also talking a little bit about the disposition of Tadej Pogacar and who he is as a person, rather than just like as a champion, because you know he's fatal on the bike, like he's a killer on the bike. But his disposition is like this really serene and kind of gentle guy who can be kind of a little bit of a clown. And as we saw yesterday when he photobombed Matej Mohoric during his TV interview, he's really just like a kid, you know. And this is a very different dynamic than, you know, Indurain or like Eddie Merckx. He's so young and he has so much time to really develop like a personality that we come to know, that I think it's just interesting to me, because I think he kind of does remind me of Merckx in the way that he talks to reporters. He's really this calm, serene guy.
Kate, I thought you'd only gone back to 2011.
Yeah.
No.
and let's not forget that Fausto Coppi won his first Giro at the same age as Pogacar. I mean, phenomenons. I say, like, oh, how come these young guys win so early? I mean, it's happened in the past.
And Eno. I mean, Eno was kind of held back.
He was held back at the start. And Merckx as well could have won before. But, I mean, these guys, that was the trend of the times. You know, hold these guys back so they might. Indurain is even worse. He rode six tours, the Tour de France, before winning it. One, but I mean, he won the Tour de l'Avenir in 1985, in 1986. I mean, he could have probably, in different times, have won a Grand Tour before he did. But yeah.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Pact Coffee. Often at the Tour de France, there's a bit of grumbling about the quality of coffee available, and admittedly, in comparison to Italy, France does lag a bit behind. Francois may disagree, but I think a lot of people do feel that. Although I must say, I do enjoy an authentic breakfast bowl of coffee in France when I can get one. I think one of the reasons that expectations are so high these days is because it's now possible to make really great coffee at home, and that's certainly the case with Pact Coffee, who supply award-winning beans or ground coffee roasted and delivered straight to your door, so you can make a really great cup of coffee at home. Pact sources the world's best beans, and they pay the farmers 55% above the fair trade base price, which ensures the farmers are making a profit to reinvest into their farms, and I think that shows in the product. Packed Coffee is delivered to your door in these letterbox-friendly packages. And if you subscribe, rest assured you're not going to have beans piling up faster than you can use them, because you can tailor your deliveries to suit you, choosing when you want a delivery, how often, and whether you want beans, ground coffee, or even pods, regular or decaf. And there's a whole menu of different styles of beans to choose from. I've been using a bag of the Bourbon Cream Espresso beans in my bean-to-cup machine at home. They arrived fresh and strong, and they've made delicious cups of coffee, whether we've gone for espresso or a nice afternoon cappuccino. So sip amazing coffee and feel good about the fact that you're helping to transform the coffee industry inside out. Packed will help you get started with £5 off your first bag. Go to packedcoffee.com, that's P-A-C-T coffee.com. Choose your flexible coffee plan, enter the code CYCLEPOD at the checkout, and get your specialty coffee delivered through your letterbox. Go to packedcoffee.com and create your coffee plan today. The code CYCLEPOD is valid when you create a Packed Coffee plan, but it's only valid for new customers.
A little reminder that on Monday, on the rest day, we'll be doing our now traditional press conference episode. If you have a question for us, it'll be myself, Francois, and Kate, just a day before Lionel joins us out here in France, in Valence, he's coming. Then email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com with an audio clip with your question. We've had quite a few already, and we look forward to receiving more. Dylan Toons, we should acknowledge, I mean, having capitalized on his name to open this episode, we really should acknowledge his stage win and the way that his team has refocused on trying to win stages and other goals after losing their leader, Jack Haig. We're going to hear from their team principal, Rolf Aldag, a little bit later on, or in a moment or two, but a very well taken win by him. He won at La Planche de Belfi a couple of years ago as well.
Yeah, I mean, we know what he's capable of. I mean, he's one of the gifted ones of in that, you know, Belgian generation of the Jasper Stuyvens, Tim Wellens. I mean, all you know, there are quite a few, all very gifted. And Toons, yeah, he likes this kind of. Let's face it, Grand Bornand is not the hardest climb to get to, even La Colombière. This is the kind of stages he likes. He, as you said, he won at La Planche de Belfi. Oddly enough, when he won at La Planche de Belfi, he decided to get married there, you know, for his marriage, to celebrate his win. And today there was another, unfortunately, not a celebration, but I mean, his granddad died shortly before the tour, and he didn't have the time to go and visit his family to honor the memory of his granddad, but he did today in brilliant fashion. And as you said, Bahrain Victorious, I mean, when they changed their, you know, sponsor name and became Bahrain Victorious, the cynical in me tended to think, you shouldn't call a team
it's
like
become
this.
A self-fulfilling prophecy.
Because if you do and you don't win, and but they do win, and
you wait, they'll all be called that next year. It'll be Ineos wins, or it'll be I don't know, UAE triumphant or something, because yeah, it's kind of worked for them, hasn't it?
And Padoun is not even there.
We don't even sound that silly saying it anymore. Well, Mark Padoun is missing, and I'm sorry he's not here because he's Ukrainian, of course, and I could have done with a Ukrainian ally before tonight's big football match.
I'm like sort of Ukrainian. My mom's side of the family is from that part of the world, so you got me, Richard.
Oh, thanks, Kay. I knew I liked you. Let's hear from Rolf Aldag, team principal at Bahrain Victorious. Interesting stuff from Rolf about how the team has kind of just responded here, as they did at the Giro when they lost Mikel Landa early on. And also, I thought it was quite interesting on Jack Haig, their leader, who's gone home. And this was the first Grand Tour that he'd led a team into.
Two stage wins in 2 days. I mean, you started out with Jack Haig as the leader, lost him, but you seem to have adjusted very successfully.
It seems to be a little bit copy and paste from the Giro. It seems to be like necessary to lose a leader and then kind of like buy into plan B and get the guys kind of like, this is just that mentality of like, okay, we had been hit really hard, but we're not defeated yet, so we fight back. And I think that was good to see. By saying that, of course, change a little bit the objective so we can do things like this yesterday and today. Go all in like there's no tomorrow, like, you know, like, I mean, for us it's a little bit to say, okay, We will be dropped tomorrow, so it will be, but we keep on fighting. We just go on a day-to-day base.
And Wout Poels as well. I mean, was that the plan today to have those two being very aggressive?
Yeah, the whole team. I mean, there was a moment with like 65 guys in the front and literally I think all of us remaining guys in there, and the whole theory was like, do we just look forward, never look back? So it doesn't matter who's behind, we just look to the front, we just keep on going. Pretty risky strategy. I mean, Wout was the key to the success, you know, with putting the bunch always under pressure. There was never a moment that they could back off, release, because with his 40 seconds a minute and everything, of course we were hoping like a group of maybe 8-9 would bridge with another one from us, and you know, but that didn't happen so early, so he just kept on going. It was pretty brave from him, kind of like sacrificed himself. Of course
there might be more interest in the stages now, in the stage wins than GC, given the performance today of Pogacar. Have you ever seen a performance like that?
Well, I haven't seen it. I've just seen the black lines on the road when he accelerated, when he lost a tire of rubber on the road. No, it's pretty impressive. And, you know, people were doubting if the team is good enough. The way it looks right now, I'd say he doesn't even need to have a strong team. But in any case, Tour is so interesting, I find, because there seems to be, like, a lot of bad luck, of course, you know, like, sorry for Roglic and Jumbo Visma, like, you know, they came here definitely with a different plan. But what it actually does is it makes the race completely open. So attacking is a strategy.
You think there's still hope then? There's still some hope for the race that Pogacar might be, if not vulnerable, then it's not, you know, with 2 weeks to go, it's not an absolute certainty that he will win.
Well, you know, rule number one is to win the Tours, you have to make it to Paris. So, you know, that's the first thing. You've seen the weather condition today. You see how filthy that is. You know, like, there will be more stages to come that are really, really hard. One hunger flat and everything can happen. So if I would be second in GC, I definitely wouldn't give up and settle in. But of course, if he just stays riding the way he's riding right now, then nobody can challenge him. And if we consider his age, then he's probably going to be the same story for the next 10 years.
Finally, Rolf, how's Jack Haig?
Well, he had surgery, he's back home, and I think, you know, he will look for new goals. We know Jack, and I think for me the most important thing was really the first 4 days, how he showed leadership, how he convinced people supporting him, because a guy who did not prove yet to be a GC rider, because he always used to help the Yates brothers or somebody else, it's not easy to say, well, you know, he's GC and everybody suffers and takes physical pain for him. But he managed to get that done in the first days by, you know, leading by presence, leading by a good example. And I think that's something he can be really, really proud of and we can build on. And that's so important to say, you know, like, you just cannot point out a GC leader, just make him GC leader by decision of the team. He has to be a natural leader. And that's something that was pretty impressive that Jack showed in the first days. And you've seen his disappointment, and that's part of the emotions that is so positive about him, that he wants to get things done, that he's just not like a guy who says, oh, I don't care. He's not, never ever this I don't care guy, and that makes him such a great bike rider. So he will heal fast, he will be back on the bike, and he will define new goals, and I think he deserves our support, you know, 100%.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2021 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, our sponsor, and we're very grateful to them for their support since 2016. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and at the checkout enter the code SISCP25. Tomorrow is Sunday, of course, and that means our Super Sunday competition in conjunction with Science and Sport. If you would like to be in with a chance of winning £80 worth of products, you can still enter to guess the winner of tomorrow's stage. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com and you can find out there how to enter. Francois, it's time for a bit of culture, but we should mention that we stayed, as we heard last night, at Chris Anstey and his wife Tamsin's house, and it was absolutely fantastic. It was a beautiful place. And we had a delicious meal of the most perfect steak. I mean, it was absolutely wonderful.
It was a beautiful steak.
Yep, it was indeed. We were in Charolles, the French capital of beef, so, and it was up to the to the standard you would expect. I was a little bit worried about, you know, the way it would be cooked, because, you know, usually well, let's say, you know, Britons don't know how to cook.
But they're Francophiles. Yeah, well, they, I mean, they've been there for 6 years.
Absolutely.
And they run perfect. You can go and stay there if you like. It's highly recommended. Chris and Tamsin are friends of the podcast, very good friends of the podcast, and they invited us to come and stay with them, which was very much appreciated. So thank you very much.
It was perfect. The beef was perfectly saignant, and Tamsin, you know, the landlady, has the same taste as me. I know you all struggle between rare, saignant, appoint, bleu. And Tamsin likes it the same as I do, between saignant and appoint.
Well done. Black, incinerated.
Anyway, it's time. Well, we're not going to forget about beef or forget about cows, because we're now in the Alps. We left, you know, it went very quickly, but we left the kind of center of France. We left the kingdoms of goat cheese to get into the strongholds of cow cheese, and the Grand Bornand is actually the capital of Reblochon. I mean, if you've been skiing, if you've been to the Alps, you've eaten Reblochon, you know how creamy it is, how tasty it is, how fruity it is. And since 1795, which is quite a long way away, there's been a market, a Reblochon market in Le Grand Bornand every Wednesday. So if you happen to be in the area on a Wednesday, don't miss it. There are actually two kinds of Reblochon. The ones that are made exclusively from all-row cow's milk, and the other one can come from different farms. So to find the real kind of monocépage, as we say for wine, you've got a green stamp on them, and if you have a red stamp on them, it comes from several herds. Anyways, the Reblochon was actually a kind of very... what was not so well known, it was kind of reserved for the locals for many years, but with the surge of skiing and winter sports and winter holidays in the 1950s and 1960s, you know, Parisians and even Britons and lots of other people came to France to ski. They discovered Reblochon, and it's really become one of the favorite cheeses made in France. There we are. This was for the cheese of the day. The word of the day, if you don't mind, I'd like to I picked the word Alp, because we're in the Alps, and Alp is also a common noun. It's not only the name of the mountains we're going around. An Alp is actually a pasture. You know, it's the place where you send cattle up in the mountains. I mean, they in the winter they live in the valley in barns, and when comes spring and summer, you kind of release free the herd and the cattle, and they'll go up the mountains in those pastures that are called Alps. So there are so many Alps around the Alps that they actually these small places, these kind of valleys up in the mountains, where actually, you know, cows and sheep and, you know, all sort of cattle graze, became gave their names to the massif. So that's why you have l'Alpe d'Huez, les deux Alpes, all these Alps we have all over the place. It's actually originally a simple noun to describe the places where the cattle was sent. Do you know where Pyrenees comes from?
Can I ask a question about that? I'll get it, but it's l'Alpe d'Huez. Is it therefore wrong? Would it be correct to say the Alpe d'Huez rather than just Alpe d'Huez?
Yeah, it would. No, I think you should say, you should actually, if you stuck to the way normally English, you know, uses foreign names, you should call it l'Alpe d'Huez, because the article le is part of the name.
Yes.
Like you say Le Havre, you're not saying Havre. So Le Havre, you should say l'Alpe d'Huez.
L'Alpe d'Huez. So we shouldn't call it Alpe d'Huez. No, you should call it l'Alpe d'Huez.
You should call it l'Alpe d'Huez, absolutely.
Where does Pyrenees come from?
Well, it's very strange because nobody knows. no, really. I mean, you had all sort of Celtic tribes and all sort of different people, and the Basque is a language not many people really know where it comes from. Basque has links with Finnish and other languages in Europe. So and Nobody knows whether the mountains down there were called Pyrenees or anything looking like Pyrenees before. So actually a legend was created to find an etymology to the Pyrenees. And what they found was you know, Hercules, he had many wives and he was kind of a womanizer. And one of the women he kind of seduced in his prime was called Pyrene. And one day,
this is juicy.
Yeah, and one day he left Pyrene and he said, okay, well, you know, to go on to another woman. And she was so sad that she got lost in the forest and had a kind of strange affair with a snake. But and in the end, Hercules and then she died. And Hercules was so Hercules was so
and she died.
Yeah, was so well. You know, at the time it was rough times, even worse than the Tour de France. And Hercules was so sad. You know, he had caused the death of Pyrene. All this is of course total bullshit. But never mind. That he was so sad that Pyrene died that he built a mausoleum for her, and the mausoleum was the Pyrenees.
Kate really perked up there at the Hercules story. She distracted her from her argument that she's having about Roglic, but she's back with us. Anyway, listen, we should go and have dinner here, but we should also mention that today we went and had a fabulous lunch as well at the L'Auberge du Père Bis on the shores of Lake Annecy. Chef Jean Sulpice welcomed us there, but we were there to meet the sommelier, a former professional bike rider, recently retired, who will be the subject of our Kilometre Zero on Monday. And it was a wonderful experience. It's a 2 Michelin star restaurant. I mean, you know, kind of normal for us to go and have lunch in a place like that. not at all. It was extraordinary. The dish we were served was phenomenal. I will post pictures of it on Monday when the episode comes out. Yeah, thoroughly enjoyable, wasn't it, Kate?
It was beautiful. It was like the most beautiful salad and sandwich I've ever had in my life.
Well, salad and sandwich makes it sound...
It was really an art piece that was, you know, if you had to pin our humble vocabulary on this culinary phenomenon which we digested, I would say that technically speaking, it was a salad and sandwich.
To be honest, the day before on the motorway at a service station,
yes,
I had a sandwich, a chicken sandwich with all the same ingredients as we had today, but for some strange reason, it didn't taste the same at all.
Yeah, I mean, it looked almost too good to eat, but not quite. I mean, you had to eat it, and it was absolutely delicious. So that will be, a really interesting episode of Kilometre Zero on Monday. Listen out for that. We take the weekend off with Kilometre Zero, of course. But it'll be back on Monday to Friday. That's all for us tonight. No song to play out with tonight because you did it at the start, but maybe we'll hear as we play out some of the... Well, you had a few goes at the Dylan song earlier, so let's hear a bit more of it because it was so enjoyable. I was sitting here being treated to this wonderful performance, as was everybody else in this bar. Heads were turning.
Well, so
never mind a hard rain falling, heads were a-turning.
Yeah, so let's wait for a Dylan Van Baar win later in the tour.
Wait, are we going to have an accompaniment or no?
No, there's no accompaniment.
Okay.
You have to do it
right,
a cappella.
Right. Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a horn.
And it's a horn.
And it's a horn.
And it's a horn.
A horn. Rain's gonna fall. Oh, wait, do I go again? Oh.
No, you're going on.
Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? Oh, what did you see, my darling young one? Sorry, I can't.
Just sing the lead straight. Yeah. We'll do it again. Don't care about me. Yeah, let's do it from scratch. Or you want to do the opposite?
No, it's hard to hear. It's hard to think about it with
the because you're not used to it.
Yeah. It's been a while.
I'm used to sing the second part harmony. So
yeah, okay. Let's do the second verse, right?
Yeah, sing it straight, you know, and I'll get in.
Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? Oh, what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with the hammers a-bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a horn. And it's a horn. And it's a horn. And it's a horn.
And it's a horn. Train.
Rain's gonna fall.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
When you think work, you think boots. You think boots, you think Ariat. You think grit, concrete, rain, and heat. And boots that never back down from any of it. You think comfort and durability that hold up on the job, off the clock, and every step in between. Because the day doesn't end when the job does. And from overtime to off-duty, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, and always back you up. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find yours at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.